Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Election day was this week with a number of local races and ballot questions. You may have missed it. A lot of voters missed election day this week. Turnout was low, very low. Just a handful of registered voters casting ballots, in fact, in some precincts. Like the number of voters you can count on one hand casting ballots in some precincts. We want to hear from voters this hour about your choices during this election day. Now, not everybody in South Florida had an election to vote in, but many people did. We want to hear if you did have that election in your community. If you could have voted, you're registered to vote, but you decided not to, why? Or maybe you didn't know about the elections. If you did vote, tell us about the choices you made and the process that you used to cast your ballot. Here's the phone number this hour, live on this Friday afternoon, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We'd love to hear from registered voters who did not vote in this election day, even though they had the opportunity. Or if you did vote, tell us about the choices you made, 800-743-9576. Now, on this Friday afternoon, one election remains undecided, the Democratic primary in the 20th Congressional District, straddling Broward and Palm Beach counties. Democrat Alcee Hastings held that seat for many, many years on Capitol Hill. He died this spring. 11 candidates were vying for that Democratic nod. Two are still just a handful of votes apart. Sheila McCormick and Dale Holness. There's a three-vote difference, according to the state elections database here on this Friday afternoon. Three-vote difference, and this triggers an automatic machine recount of the ballots. Let's get the latest with Katie Swetalski-Munoz, our Broward County reporter at WLRN. Katie, what is the latest this Friday afternoon with the recount? Is it underway?
Hi, Tom. Yes. So, as you mentioned, I mean, three votes, but the machine recount was happening at the Broward County Supervisor of Elections warehouse in Lauderhill this morning. And our WLRN reporter, Danny Rivero, is there watching for, you know, the canvassing board, what votes they're throwing out for things like signature mismatches. But the machine recount is expected to be over soon. And this hour, they're anticipating beginning the hand recount process. And so those get triggered, you know, by Florida law when the candidates are under half of 1% apart. That's what triggers this machine recount. Now, when you get to an even smaller margin, under a quarter of a percent, that's when a hand recount is an option for both candidates and their team of election lawyers.
Yeah. And we're already there. I think the three vote difference is 1/100th of a percent difference right now. So undoubtedly going to this hand recount. You have witnessed a number of recounts in Broward County. What is that process like?
I have. The last election night watch party I went to for a candidate was that fateful night in 2018, and I was at Nikki Fried's watch party. And that also ended in a very undecided race that went to a statewide recount. But what that looks like in Broward is it's simple and it's kind of like organized chaos, but there is a direct process to it. And so you have a canvassing board that meets and they're looking at any ballots that come into question during a machine recount, during a hand recount, any vote by mail ballots that have a question about them. Oftentimes, if you have anyone that's not the voter signing the envelope of the vote by mail ballot, that is cause for rejection. And we've seen that in this race. So you have a canvassing board that's directly looking at problem ballots or ballots that come into question. But then in this giant warehouse, you have election workers and volunteers refeeding every single ballot through different machines, almost like it's election night 2.0. They're doing the exact same thing. But you've got to recalibrate all the machines to make that happen and do all of the logic and accuracy testing.
So what kind of timeline are we operating under to try to settle this 20th Congressional Democratic primary so that there's a candidate for voters to select from during the upcoming primary or the upcoming general election?
Yeah, so they're hoping to finish the hand recount today. This race is special because there are so few votes. You don't have to count an entire state's worth of voters all over again like you did in 2018. Right. This is a much, much smaller pool of votes because you talked about the low turnout this election cycle. And so they're going to hopefully get to a second round of unofficial election results by the end of the day today, according to the canvassing board's schedule. But they still have to, you know, next Friday, they still have to look for any of the overseas or military ballots that come in. And man, even if they only get 5 to 10 of those back in a race that's separated right now by 3 votes, that could turn the election.
Yeah, indeed. A real-time example of how every ballot cast
counts.
Yeah, every single one in this case. Katie Sotowski-Munoz, our Broward County reporter here at WLRN. And Katie, thanks for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We're talking about Election Day that was this week here in many communities in South Florida. Lining up your phone calls, did you vote? Did you know there was an election? Did you decide not to participate? 800-743-WLRN on the phone. We'll get to your phone calls in a moment. 800-743-9576. We're going to ask you to wait on the phone a little bit longer than you would have had to wait in a voting line if you chose to cast a ballot, because turnout was awfully low, below 20%. Amy Driscoll is with us. Amy is the deputy editorial page editor with our news partner, the Miami Herald. Steve Bosquet is the editorial page editor at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Tony Doris has that position at the Palm Beach Post. All three of you, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Steve, let me start with you. What do you make of how close this race is in the 20th Congressional District?
Well, it's amazing. I was at the Broward Election Center last night and watched as they included into the pool of ballots, provisional ballots, people who'd file those affidavits because there was some dispute about their identity. And under the law, they have till 2 days after the election to reconcile that. And about more than a dozen people did that remotely through the supervisor's office. It was good to see that. But as we've said in the Sun Sentinel, Tom, it has appeared in this race that there were more candidates than voters.
A little bit of an exaggeration, but not by much, Steve.
Right. I mean, to have 11 candidates in the Democratic primary is highly unusual. And this race is so close that it is, and I bring this up with some reluctance, but it is appropriate to answer the question that might be on some listeners' minds. They're separated by 3 votes. It keeps getting closer. What happens if this race ends in a tie, which is more than a theoretical possibility at this point? And the answer under Florida law is, like as it is in most states, the election is decided by lot. They will draw lots, and somebody will go to Congress in a lottery drawing.
Draw lots, meaning drawing straws, essentially.
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this manual recount is really only a review of the overvotes and undervotes, of which I think I heard last night there are about fewer than 200 ballots. But my gut tells me that we're headed for one more surprise in this race. I just don't.
Your gut speaks with a lot of experience when it comes to Florida politics, Steve. Tony, I hear you. I heard a chagrin there a little bit about Steve's prediction of yet another surprise.
Yeah, Palm Beach people are a little bit leery about recounts. So we've had a little bit of experience with that. But I got to say, Tom, you know, while you talk about bad turnout, it was 16%. You know, it's an off-year election, and it was delayed a little bit by the governor's scheduling after the congressman died, and it took a while for the governor to put this one on the books. But the good news to it all, and maybe the reason for the bad turnout, is you had a number of really good candidates. In Palm Beach, we interviewed the 11 Democratic candidates, and there were a number. There were, you know, 5 or 6 who we thought would have made perfectly fine congresspeople. And maybe voters didn't distinguish much between one and the other, but I think Amy and Steve will tell you money had a big part to play in how it all worked out as well.
Yeah, the highest, the most successful fundraiser was Sheila McCormick, who is in this tight race with Dale Holness. Policies.
I don't
also
know that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. I don't know that she was the most successful fundraiser because she raised millions of her own money. Money she got from outside of her own pocket was not that significant.
Fair enough. Yeah, she donated lots of her own money toward it, as opposed to other people's money, spending her own money, not other people's money. But the policies involved here, Tony, with these two candidates that are vying for every single vote here after Election Day, how much of this race is really reflecting the battle inside the National Democratic Party between a more moderate voice that may be represented by Dale Holness and a more progressive voice represented by Sheila McCormick.
You know, I honestly, in listening to the two of them speak across the table from me, didn't detect that strong a difference between them. So I think it would be more likely that it came down to people feeling comfortable with the candidate rather than a specific viewpoint. I mean, I just finished looking back over my notes of both those interviews, and you see a lot of the same issues. So we need Holness focused a lot on small business and entrepreneurs needing help. And they both focused on the need for affordable housing and jobs. And so, you know, the labels moderate and progressive didn't hold. There were other candidates that you could clearly say, oh, he's far to the left, you know, Omari Hardy. But these two, maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't hear it when I spoke to them.
Let me bring Amy Driscoll into the conversation with the Miami Herald. Amy, what are some of the takeaways for other Democrats in South Florida who hope to flip at least two congressional districts in Dade County next year with this tight race in the 20th district?
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here. I think, you know, there were one of the things we saw with this race was that, you know, there were so many people and there were so many. They really covered the spectrum of what the Democrats are dealing with within their own party. So I think, you know, that whole idea of splitting the vote is definitely there. But I also really want to say that I think that, you know, we in the press and in politics really want to dissect these kinds of races and figure them out. But these off-year elections aren't always an indicator of a lot of other things. And that's something that we have to pay attention to. There has been, you know, several attempts over the years. There have been several attempts over the years to move these off-cycle elections to presidential years, or at least the midterms. And, you know, I kind of think that's what needs to happen. I think it's not really serving the voters to expect them to pay attention, you know, and to allow these seats to be chosen by such a small number of people.
Incredibly small number of people, right? I mean, maybe some of these races had one in every five eligible voters actually have their voice heard when it comes to election.
Right. And I think that showed, if, you know, we get down to this three vote margin, not the ideal way to run an election.
You can count it on one hand, literally, in this case, literally in one. I mean, it really is remarkable. We're talking about Election Day. Yes, there was an election in South Florida, many communities, with three of the opinion page editors here in South Florida. Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald. She's the deputy editorial page editor. Steve Bosquet is the editorial page editor at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Tony Doris has that position at the Palm Beach Post. Let's hear from Ron in Homestead on line two. Ron, thanks for calling in. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
So you asked the question earlier for the call-in as to why some of the registered voters didn't vote, and as I told you, it turns out that my schedule had absorbed the entire day. It was from about 5:30 a.m. to about 9 p.m., and it left zero window for me to actually get in there and vote, which was a disappointment, but I really had no choice. And one of the things I had done is asked other friends that I'm familiar with, they're very close to, and I do some political stuff on the side, why they didn't vote. And it turns out that it was exactly the same reason as mine, with the exception of the elderly that were retired. They had the opportunity to go vote, but everybody 50 or under that was working, it really was reflective that they just couldn't get there. And I was wondering if it was the older part of the community that actually decided these elections, as slim as they are.
I'll put that to the group here in one moment, Ron, but let me ask you about any ability that you had to participate via vote by mail or any early voting locations.
You know, I had considered it. I was certain that I would be able to make the to get to the voting booth in time, but I was asked to stay late, and it literally took it away from me.
Yeah.
So it's really my fault not having voted early. I should have considered it. I was just one of those in-person voters that just didn't get the opportunity, and it's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you something else. The huge effort to stop early voting confused the issue a lot with my friends. I knew better, but they did not.
Hmm. Interesting point, Ron. Thanks for calling and listening there from Homestead. Steve Vasquez, let me put it to you first, his original question there about the demographics. I don't think we know just yet the demographical information regarding who voted in this election, do we yet?
No, we don't without some serious digging. It's out there, it's available, but it's so the recount and other factors have, you know, been a distraction, of course.
Yeah.
But I can tell you anecdotally that most of the vote, the participating voters in this election undoubtedly skewed older. First of all, it is a demonstrable fact about election behavior that the older you are, the higher propensity you have to vote.
Yeah.
Voting,
exactly. Yeah.
Voting is something that's done as voters are creatures of habit. And the more you vote, the more likely you are to keep voting. The difficult part is to get young people to start voting, because once you start voting, you generally will continue doing it.
Yeah.
So there's that. And I think that, you know, I went to Kings Point and Tamarack on Election Day, and which is a retirement community, obviously. And the voters I saw there were in their late 50s, 60s, and older.
Mm. Amy, what do you make of Ron's observation that some of his friends had experienced some confusion around early voting? You know, the process of voting has come under incredible scrutiny in the last year and a half or so, certainly into the 2020 election. And a lot of that scrutiny, debate and rhetoric, and some of it misinformation and disinformation has continued.
Sure. I think there have been an awful lot of different kinds of voting available to us now. And I think that certainly is a little bit confusing to people. There's early voting, there's vote by mail, which, you know, has sometimes been questioned in this state. And then there's actually the election day vote. So I think that, you know, there's a possibility that people can get confused, but there are also more ways than there ever have been. And it lasts longer than it ever did.
Right.
So there are literally weeks in which to cast your ballot. So I think that that makes it much easier for voters. But of course, there have been efforts to undermine some of that and to shut down some of the conveniences that have been put in place, like places to drop off your ballot.
Yep. Yeah, Election Day has turned into election season with as much voting process, voting methods that are available here in Florida. Marcia is with us in Fort Lauderdale. Marcia, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Hello. My question is, did some of the polls close early that you're aware of? Because when I went to my polling place, it didn't look as though it had been open at all. It was 6:30 in the evening.
Marcia, could you share with us which polling place you visited?
Yes, it's the Pipe Fitters Union on Andrews Avenue. My precinct is R45.
This is where you voted in the past?
Yes, and I double-checked when I went home because I thought, wow, maybe they changed the polling place and I missed it, but that's still what's listed online.
Yeah, you anticipated my next question, Marcia. Well done there. Steve?
Tom, I will ask Joe Scott, the Broward election supervisor, that very question. We love hearing from voters about this. I find that hard to believe, but I don't discount what the voter is saying. If the Pipe Fitters Union is in the 20th Congressional District, it is an extreme no-no to close the polling place early, even if there are no voters. This is what partly cost the former Broward supervisor, Miriam Oliphant, her job. My colleague, Amy Driscoll, will well remember that saga from 20 years ago. You do not shut a polling place down early, ever.
You know, Tom, if I can...
Please do.
Two cents in. I think, touching on what Amy said... You know, polling places generally are closed at 7 o'clock anyway, so people who are working have a hard time getting to the polls unless they can somehow get there early or late. But that's why all the recent discussions over the past few years about should there be drop boxes, how many early voting days should there be? I think the inconsistency and the back and forth and the conflicting news reports, you know, over the years might well be showing an impact, because they do confuse people. It's not like, you know, let's just do what we did last year. maybe people don't know what to do anymore when it comes to voting day.
And if I could jump in also, I would add that if you are a computer literate person with lots of ability to look things up online, you're probably going to find that out for yourself. But if you are a person maybe who reads the actual newspaper and still wants to go to your old polling place, it might actually be very confusing and difficult for you to find your polling place or know where to go.
Yeah, it's akin to the early days of the vaccinations when many of the most vulnerable did not have access to social media, weren't plugged in with a high-speed internet connection, hitting refresh, trying to sign up for a early vaccine appointment. And there developed a whole kind of underground support group of people who were able to try to secure those early vaccine appointments for those most vulnerable, seeing perhaps some of that, again, having to play out because of how voting has changed. Let's hear from Fernie in Hialeah, big mayoral race in Hialeah, where former President Trump played a role. Fernie, thanks for calling and listening. You're on the radio.
No, thank you for taking my call. Absolutely. I got to say that in Hialeah, we were a pretty active political community. It is an elderly community. So though I did see it did appear to be even in early voting, you could see that there was the turnout wasn't quite what it usually is. I mean, I've voted in every election since I'm 18. So and I'm 53 now. So absolutely. I keep an eye on that. And I do want to say that though the numbers were less, they were still pretty active here in Hialeah. And on Tuesday, it was desolate. That was definitely that. It was like a very, 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 very quiet polling location. I will say that I want to say that I think that a part of this all comes from also the fact that, at least in our city, we do not have a very big, it's not very diverse in its political candidates. I am a left-leaning independent, and I know a lot of friends who did not go out to vote because all they had to vote for in the mayoral race, for example, was right-leaning Republicans, either right or further right. So it's not just maybe getting the information out there, but your choice of candidates has a lot to do with that.
Fernie, I appreciate that perspective. Tony, that is a common refrain we hear from voters before, during, and after almost every election cycle, particularly those voters that did not feel motivated to show up. Fernie, of course, is a motivated super voter there in Hialeah. But for those who need motivation, will look at the ballot and say, these candidates aren't talking to me. They're not speaking to me or for me.
Yeah, well, it's also one of the reasons why the League of Women Voters and Fair Districts and other nonprofit are pushing so hard to get around gerrymandering. I mean, I can't say for sure what happened in Hialeah. But if voting districts are mapped out and designed so that one party or another or one particular politically leaning group or another is bound to win the election, then you're not going to get, you know, a spectrum of candidates. You're going to get candidates who are, you know, all the way on one side or the other. And that's happened all around the state. Hopefully when they drop the maps this time, they're in the middle of that 10-year process right now of redistricting statewide. Hopefully they'll get it right this time around.
Yeah, incredibly important issue when it comes to those congressional districts. I do want to bring just Amy's voice into this because Fernie was talking to us from Hialeah. And I did, Amy, make mention that the former president, a part-time South Florida resident, did not make an actual appearance in Hialeah, but certainly had his voice heard in that race, in a local mayoral race. Hialeah is not a small city by any stretch, but in a local mayoral race, the former commander-in-chief of the United States decides to play a role. What kind of takeaway does that have for you?
Well, you know, we don't know for sure what kind of an effect that had on the campaign of Esteban Steve Bobo, who did end up winning the mayoral election in Hialeah. But certainly the idea that the former president would weigh in on something, you know, which is a very local election was surprising. And yet, you know, Trump did so well in Miami-Dade County and, you know, obviously in Florida, but Miami-Dade County specifically, and also among Hispanics in Miami-Dade County. And so I think it was a nod to that. And he worked really hard to get those votes right up to the presidential election. I believe he stopped at a midnight rally at one of the local airports right before the election. So it's although it is unusual, considering that was a very strong place for him, I think it was, you know, kind of expected in a way.
Let's hear
hey, Tom,
from.
I got,
yeah,
like
go ahead.
A quick point. If I yes, I'm doing a little research here. Well, so that previous caller who wondered why the pipe fitters union might have been closed at 6:30 on Tuesday night, I can give you a reason why. According to the supervisor's website, precinct R45 is not in the 20th congressional district.
So there was no vote.
Election
there was
it
no vote to be
like
cast.
It, no vote to be cast. I yeah. got a couple of voters who contacted me this week.
Yep.
I mean, I appreciate, you know, it's a bit of confusion, but yeah. I can appreciate the their concern. But I think that they didn't have an election. It looks to me like that precinct, which is on South Andrews Avenue near State Road 84, is in Ted Deutsch's district.
Right.
So, I
appreciate you doing a little bit of real-time research there, Steve Bosquet, with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. But it does speak to the off-year election cycle. Amy, you were making this point. We heard this point also, that in the community that I live in, we did not have an election. I had no polling place to go to. My wife and I had no ballot to cast. But, you know, right across just a couple blocks away, our neighbors did have a ballot to cast. So it speaks to this off-year election cycle. Hyper-local elections, very important, certainly, but also can add to the voter confusion and maybe a bit of, Amy, voter, not apathy per se, but just being overwhelmed by politics over the last several years.
I'm sure that's true. Yeah. I think we all feel a little overwhelmed by politics the last few years. The turnout in Miami-Dade County was just under 17%. And just to give you an idea, the presidential race was 75%.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how different it is with an off cycle election. Like I said, this isn't even just a midterm. This is, you know, an only local election. So it is hard to engage voters. And I think that should be a warning to the people who try to do that, that maybe, you know, those tried and true ways of reaching people when they are, you know, informed ahead of time, maybe there needs to be a little more effort taken to get to them. And even as that voter who was confused about her polling place in which election she was voting in, that, again, that should be a warning sign to the people who are trying to reach voters.
Yeah. Understandable.
Well, to add to what I said a minute ago, that 20th congressional district is one of the most gerrymandered or strangely shaped districts in the whole state. And it was done so intentionally and you know, with good intentions to make sure that there was a minority Black, a district in which Blacks were the majority. And so you get this strange shaped thing that goes all the way from the middle of Broward County through the agricultural areas of Palm Beach and then hooks a right and goes to Riviera Beach. Right. So it's you might not even know what your district is in. It's very easy to get confused like that and not know who's on your slate of candidates.
Indeed it is. We're talking about Election Day. We're going to get to some specific races, specific ballot questions, booze in Miami Beach, mayoral races in the beach and in the city of Miami. We want to hear from you. 800-743-9576. Three of the editorial page writers here in South Florida are with us. We want to hear from you. Did you vote? Did you have a chance to vote? Did you decide not to participate in democracy this time around? Let us know. 800-743-WLRN as the South Florida Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public broadcasting. We're talking about Election Day, election season, this off-year, odd-year election season. Odd for not only the number of year, but also an odd, very low turnout in voting across South Florida with different municipal elections. Miami Beach voters had another chance to decide if they wanted an earlier last call on South Beach. This time they voted for a 2 a.m. closing call. Here is Mayor Dan Gelber this week.
I look forward to helping any of these bars sort of evolve into a different kind of business model. But the truth of the matter is our residents cannot be held captive to a business model that creates disorder.
voters just 4 years ago on the beach rejected the earlier closing call for bars and nightclubs on South Beach. 800-743-9576 to have your voice heard as we continue to talk about election season with Amy Driscoll, deputy editorial page editor at our news partner, the Miami Herald. Steve Bosquet is the editorial page editor at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Tony Doris is the editorial page editor at the Palm Beach Post. Amy, what about this booze vote on the beach, a non-binding referendum, but why do you think it found support this year where it failed 4 years ago?
This issue really became exacerbated during the pandemic. I think that's at the heart of this. You know, Miami Beach, South Beach has been a party destination for a really long time now, but during the pandemic, with Florida being, you know, considered open, and I put that in quote marks, because of DeSantis, our governor's moves, there we had a lot of tourism. It really didn't slow down much, and people took to the streets for these street parties. We shut down some of the motor traffic, and then it became a pedestrian way, and that became just these out of control parties that required a lot of policing, and people became very weary on Miami Beach. And I think that's what was at play here.
It's a non-binding referendum. So now comes, first of all, the city commission has to take an action, assuming that it does, it has to be implemented. And there's been some talk of not having a hard and fast 2 a.m. last call, right?
Right. I think there's a lot of room for negotiation still. This, as you say, it was a non-binding, you know, straw ballot.
Yep,
56% of people voted for it. So, you know, that's a strong yes, but not an overwhelming yes. And there was always the idea that, you know, the city will have to figure out now, the commission will have to figure out now exactly what that's going to mean. I think they are respectful of the idea that these bar owners, you know, pay taxes and provide a lot of jobs, and they don't want to quash that. So there's going to be some give and take there. But it's also the place where the mischief can be made. And that's, I think, the concern that, you know, maybe the commission, you know, might be favoring a specific person or company.
Steve Bosquet, let me bring you into this conversation, because in Broward County, Fort Lauderdale went through something similar in terms of trying to change a reputation of a place, to try to change that wild spring break reputation that it had for many decades, and try to swing it towards something that was more family friendly. I mean, we're hearing some of those same calls from Mayor Gelber and South Beach here. What are the lessons learned?
I think you need a replacement strategy very quickly. It's funny you asked the question. I was a young cub covering the city of Fort Lauderdale when they decided to abolish spring break. I remember it well. I was in Fort Lauderdale. It was in the mid 1986 thereabouts. And spring break had done extreme amount of damage, I felt, to the city of Fort Lauderdale's reputation. And they tried to throw a switch overnight and make it a family-friendly destination. That's unrealistic.
Yeah.
Particularly since the image of Fort Lauderdale as a college spring break destination had been celebrated, you know, in the movie Where the Boys Are, and marketed very aggressively by the community. Fort Lauderdale, like where Dan Gelber is in Miami Beach, Fort Lauderdale has an extremely aggressive and active hospitality lobbying industry. They are very vocal, and it's gotten much larger in the intervening decades. Now, for example, when they abolished spring break in Fort Lauderdale, they didn't even have the convention center yet. So there was nothing really to replace spring break with, and it has taken a long time to put that together here.
We're talking about Election Day. Want to hear from you. How did you vote? What was the process like? Did you decide not to cast a ballot in this election? 800-743-9576. Dave is with us in Fort Lauderdale. Go ahead, Dave. Thanks for listening.
Hi, thank you. I'm another one in that precinct, R045, that I went about 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning attempting to vote, and the doors were locked at that time as well.
Yep. We got an answer for you, Dave. Steve, you want to let him know what you found out?
Yeah, Dave, my reading of available information is that precinct R045 in Fort Lauderdale is in the congressional district of Ted Deutsch, not of congressional district 20, which had a special election. So you should check your voter registration card, which will list on it which congressional district to register to vote in. If my information is right, you're in congressional district 22, not 20. It's an understated mistake, but I think that's what happened.
And Dave, if that's different from what you have on your voter registration card, please be sure to let us know. But we do appreciate the phone call and listening there. Alberto in Miami, line 4. Alberto, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Hello. I would like to know from the editors of the different papers, why is it that their final political editorial recommendations for candidates usually come out a couple of days fully before the election day rather than earlier at the start of the early voting?
Alberto, good question. Tony, let's start with you up at the Palm Beach Post about the timing of publishing endorsements.
Endorsements. I think we came out right around the time when early voting was starting and not earlier. I don't know. We just thought that was the appropriate day. We didn't want to. We thought our purpose would be muted if we just did the endorsement the day before, a couple of days before. So we wanted everybody to have a chance, especially since there's a lot of early voting in Palm Beach County.
Yeah. Steve, any publication strategy at the Sentinel with its endorsements you could share with us?
Yes, I can. And thank you so much to the caller for raising the question, raising the point, because this is definitely going to bring some full disclosure on our part. I feel as the editorial page editor that what we do should be fully transparent. And it is. Our endorsement of in this race came out on October 1st. And unlike my colleagues in Palm Beach and Miami, the Sun Sentinel recommended a progressive candidate, Omari Hardy, in the race. And we did it precisely to address the concerns the caller raised. We wanted the endorsement to be out there as people were getting their vote by mail ballots. And so we did. And it was subsequent to our recommendation of Hardy that this controversy mushroomed, that Omari Hardy is a supporter of the BDS movement, which is boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel.
Right.
For its Palestinian policy. That's a longer, different conversation. But my point is, we wanted the endorsement to be out there well in advance of most people voting.
Yeah. Amy, I want to hear your voice in this, because the example Steve gives is a perfect example of wanting, you know, publishing early, but not perhaps having an endorsement consider what the cliche of the October surprise.
That's exactly right. And it's a struggle. It's a tension. We have the same issues. We think about, when is it going to be most useful for voters to know what we think after the interviews that we do with everyone, but also how close can we get to the election without there being more information that comes out afterwards, and then we have to go back perhaps and rewrite our recommendation. It's a problem, because these elections now stretch out for weeks.
Yeah.
So and so much for the power of the press, Tom, too. I mean, neither the Post nor the Sentinel picked the winner or endorsed the winner.
And we try to be as useful as we can to readers. I think that's the goal. But readers also have to bear with us if we have to change our minds if things change. I mean, we can only work with the information that is out there at the time.
Change our minds when the facts change. That's the way it all works. All right, stick with us here. Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald, Steve Bosquet with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Tony Doris with the Palm Beach Post. We'll be joined by Miami-Dade County's chief heat officer. Get ready for heat season in South Florida, and this season has nothing to do with basketball. That's next as the South Florida Roundup continues. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The heat season is underway, the basketball season, that is. Next summer is going to bring the first heat season, heat with a small h, as in an official declaration of hot weather. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava announced this week that the county is declaring its first ever heat season, May 1st through October 31st. She made the announcement Tuesday during a panel at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, Scotland.
We will do this with the support of our chief heat officer, but also the heat task force, which is focusing on vulnerable populations, those who are least likely to be able to afford to live in places that will stay naturally cool.
That chief heat officer mentioned by the mayor is Jane Gilbert, and she joins us now on the South Florida Roundup. Jane, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to have you again.
Nice to be here, Tom. Thank you.
So the question that I'm sure you've answered dozens of times since this announcement is, what is a heat season?
That's a great question, other than, as you mentioned earlier, our favored team, basketball team, whose heat season is separate from ours. Really, this is to raise awareness about the risks associated with extreme heat on the level that our community does such a great job of raising awareness about how to prepare for hurricanes. You know, extreme heat is the silent killer amongst weather-related events. It causes more deaths annually than hurricanes, flooding, forest fires, or any other weather or climate-related event. So this is to make sure that we're all prepared.
As a practical matter, Jane, what does an official declaration from the mayor's office or in Miami-Dade County do?
So it directs the administration and, my role as chief heat officer is not only to work internally within the county administration, but with our key partners, those being the National Weather Service, our health department and healthcare partners, as well as our school district, employers, et cetera, to work with them to make sure, like a hurricane season, we create a campaign, an education campaign to inform people that, yes, we're all vulnerable, but there are particular people who are more vulnerable. And there are things people can do to reduce both the health risks as well as the economic burden of increasing heat.
Will certain activities be discouraged or prohibited during this heat season?
So I think what we'll do is do a better job of informing people how to adapt their schedules, whether it's, people working outside, kids playing outside, recreation and sports activities, to make sure people have access to potable water and shade and breaks during the hottest times. So it's about adapting schedules, making sure potable water is available. We have a lot of outdoor events here. We need to make sure that people have access to water in those high heat times.
Jane, let me ask about just how you're thinking ahead toward this heat season. It may be underway during a pandemic where a lot of public water fountains, for instance, in parks have been turned off because of public health concerns.
Yeah, so we need to adapt those water fountains to be able to dispense water for reusable water bottles so that people can access that water and use it, because we have to have that available.
I also want to ask you just about the kind of official meteorological declaration for a heat advisory. People may be familiar with that phrase, right? That comes from the National Weather Service. And here in South Florida, that heat advisory doesn't come into play until there's a feel-like temperature of 108 degrees for two hours. That is beyond sweltering.
It is. It is something that's been determined by the National Weather Service at a regional level. It is something they're open to reconsidering, because most heat-related hospitalizations happen below that level.
Would you push for the National Weather Service to bring that heat advisory threshold to a lower temperature?
Yeah, we're in discussion. It is a regional, when I say regional, multi-state level. So we are a partner in that discussion, but absolutely they're open to having that discussion. Other cities have reduced their heat advisory and warning levels recently, such as Washington, D.C. So we're New York City. So we're looking to model after some of the work that they did.
Share with us some of that conversation and the response you've gotten from the National Weather Service.
The response is they're open to revisiting it, and we just need to get an outline from them of what that looks like and what the timeline is.
Yeah. We're speaking with the chief heat officer of Miami-Dade County, Jane Gilbert. We learned this week from Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava announcing that there'll be the first ever heat season May 1st through October 31st next spring, summer, and fall, a first declaration heat season in South Florida. Still with us, Amy Driscoll, the deputy editorial page editor with the Miami Herald, Steve Bosquet, the editorial page editor at the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Tony Doris with the Palm Beach Post has that same title. Amy, what are your thoughts about this movement toward an official heat declaration and coming at a global climate conference by a local mayor?
Yeah, I know that that heat is costing more and more money to all of us. We have so many outdoor workers in Florida, and as things continue, it's going to get harder and harder for them to do their jobs at certain parts of the year. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a financial question here. I'm curious about the what our chief heat officer believes are going to be the takeaways from that climate summit in Miami Beach in March. It's going to be a big deal, and of course, it's here where we are considered to be ground zero. What are you hoping to take away from that?
So I think what we're hoping is that by having the really truly internationalized, this is going to be the Art Basel of climate summits here in Miami and Miami Beach, that this will further accelerate investment in our local move towards carbon neutral economy and our local move towards a more resilient greater Miami. This will bring great ideas, potential financial opportunities to invest in that transition.
Tony, with the Palm Beach Post, let me ask your impressions of this. It's happening, in the region, in your neighborhood, in a place that there's been a lot of teamwork amongst the four counties in South Florida when it comes to climate change.
Yeah, I think it's great, any bit of attention that can be shed on climate change. I mean, we haven't been as far advanced as, say, Miami Beach has been in addressing this, but the things like sea level rise are getting attention. We're soaking up whatever federal grants we can get to do seawalls. I was just going to joke that, for this campaign, I could see them putting Paris Hilton heading their marketing with, heat is not hot. She's a Miami Beacher, so.
You're showing your age, Tony, with that kind of reference. Come on. That's not what the kids are into these days. Right. Bosquet, how about you from Broward County? Again, a key partner in the Southeast Florida Climate Compact that's been around for better than a decade now.
Yeah, I would like to ask Ms. Gilbert. Obviously, the bulk of my readers and followers are in Palm Beach and Broward counties, and we've got the exact same weather, as you know. Jennifer Gerardo, your colleague, the resident officer for Broward County, how often do you and Jennifer talk, and what do you talk about?
Thank you, Steve. Actually, this coming Monday, we are giving a whole workshop, half-day workshop, for the municipalities and counties of the whole Southeast Florida Compact, so Palm Beach down to the Keys, on how to address heat. We have well over, I think, 150 registrants for that workshop, where we're bringing in national experts as well as I'll be speaking. So we'll be sharing tools and resources for all the cities and counties to develop their own heat plans. Also, and Jennifer has been part of that planning process, actually. We also just released, we being myself in the Office of Resilience at Miami-Dade County, a heat health toolkit that's generally geared towards Miami-Dade County, but is absolutely transferable with interventions and solutions that Palm Beach County, Broward County, municipalities and counties can use.
Jane, we appreciate you sharing with that. Sorry for the interruption. We're up against the clock here at WLRN, so we got to let it go. Jane Gilbert is the Chief Heat Officer of Miami-Dade County. Jane, thanks again for sharing your expertise with us and our audience.
My pleasure.
Amy Driscoll, the Deputy Editorial Page Editor at the Miami Herald, Steve Bosquet, Editorial Page Editor at the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Tony Doris, the Editorial Page Editor at the Palm Beach Post. Amy, Steve, Tony, thanks for spending the entire hour with us today. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Always a pleasure. This will do it there for this edition of the South Florida Roundup. It is produced by Sherilyn Cabrera and Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations at WLRN and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public broadcasting here in South Florida. Our program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. WLRN Public Media.